90 The Fan.
Happy Friday. It's Jay's Talk Plus. It's Blake Murphy. It's Julia Kreutz.
Happy City Connect evening.
And Pride Night at the ballpark. Get a little, what are they calling it instead of a fanny pack?
It is a crossbody bag, I think it is.
Which you would just never name something that if you are a wrestling fan like me, because a crossbody is a very specific move you would do off the top rope. So a crossbody bag to me is like you killed someone with a crossbody off the top.
I love that so much more.
Because then you get the body bag part and the crossbody. Yes. So to me, it sounds like you're blending crossbody and body bag, not a crossbody bag.
Those are the pride vibes that I want to bring tonight.
Yeah, there you go. I am not a dad, but to me, a fanny pack is not only like pretty dad-coded, but that is what I have to call it.
Right. Yeah, it is what it is, and I understand that it's a little silly as far as, you know, names of things go.
Yes, names of things.
But that's the name.
As an actual accessory, though,
we love it.
Yes, I won't be at the game tonight to get one. I'm going to see City in Color tonight. But
good for you.
I did appreciate a couple years ago where, like, fanny packs were like briefly back in. Not that I am a fashionable guy who cares about what's in or not in.
What are you talking about?
But like
about?
In the summertime, there is not like pocket space is fairly limited. I have earbuds and keys and a wallet and a cell phone and stuff like that. I want to maybe bring sunscreen because when you have lots of tattoos, you have to be very, very Absolutely. Careful with sunscreen. Everyone should be careful with sunscreen anyway. But yeah. The short window there where, like, yeah, you could wear a fanny pack. It's not weird. It's not a dad thing.
I don't know. I think
it went weird again. Like, I think it's not an accepted accoutrement
Maybe
anymore.
You should hang out with more queer people. Because legitimately, I mean, we are a fanny pack household 100,000%. My friends are as well. I don't know. I don't think that that ever left the zeitgeist in that community.
Good to know.
You know.
So like in my neighborhood, it'll be fine.
It will. Oh, yes. You will fit right in.
Not to tell the whole audience where I live. All right. There was some baseball yesterday. We will talk Blue Jays Pride Night a little bit more. Michelle Seniak from the Blue Jays is going to join us around 11:35 to talk about what they're doing for Pride Night, what community groups they're working with, why this is important to the organization. We'll talk about it ourselves a little bit as well. James Fagan is going to join us at 11 o'clock from Sox Machine and Baseball America. He is the go-to guy on the Chicago White Sox, which I actually mean as a compliment, not derogatory as much as it might seem that way from the last couple years of Sox coverage. Yes, we're going to ask him when his exclusive with the Pope is coming. We'll also get to know the White Sox who are here for three. And a week or two ago, we might have thought the White Sox, that's not as easy on paper as it seemed, you know, certainly last year. They've lost eight in a row and they got swept in a doubleheader yesterday and they're not a particularly competitive team.
Yeah, it's... I get sad when those things happen because I love to talk about youth movement and what's coming. And
the Rockies almost won six in a row.
Yeah.
They got walked off yesterday afternoon. James
That's
Wood
right.
walked them off. One of my guys, not quite Joe Adell level, but one
I'm
of my guys.
Track of these.
Yes. Jorge Castillo will also join us around 10:35. We'll talk a little Yankees. They snapped a losing streak yesterday and beat those Angels, but they're in a bad way offensively. They're in a bad way bullpen-wise, such that Luke Weaver, who was expected to be out for 6 weeks, might return tonight after only 2.5 weeks because Jake Cousins' rehab got stopped, and he's headed for TJ. Yiri De Los Santos is on the IL as well. We'll talk a little Mets, too, because every New York team went on a six-game losing streak this week. I don't know what the deal is there.
Wow. The Weaver stuff... I'm very much looking forward to hearing what Castillo has to say, because this is not necessarily something that you would expect a team to do. It doesn't seem like long-term it's good for anyone involved. We'll see. We'll get some the take of someone who's a little closer to the action than we are.
And the Yankees perhaps feeling the heat, because heading into yesterday, the Toronto Blue Jays had closed the gap in the American League East to two games. The Tampa Bay Rays had closed the gap in the American League East to a game and a half. And then the Blue Jays lost, the Yankees won, so that gap's back to three. Scary moment in the Tampa Bay game where Adley Rutschman hit a 105-mile-hour liner into the dugout and hit Hunter Biggie, and there was a delay there, and he had to be stretchered off. That was a scary one. And then, look, the Jays do not have – we talked about this on Rivalry Week, and we talked about it on the show and with John Schneider. The Jays don't have a natural rival. when I see the Padres and Dodgers getting into it last night, I'm a little jealous.
Yeah.
I don't need, you know, guys being thrown at necessarily, but the chirpiness, the clear the benches, that's a division rivalry. They've seen a lot of each other the last 2 weeks. That will get revisited later in the season and perhaps in the postseason. I was a little envious of that. And then I was thinking, if it's not going to be a series against the Diamondbacks, or maybe there are just too many like former teammates in this series,
yeah.
but there were like 30 hit by a pitch over three games.
Yes. Poor Andrés Giménez. That was the one thing I could think of. He just came back from injury. Let's just give him some time to get acclimated. This is a new team. You know, he can't really afford to miss any more time here. It's funny to think that he's been on base every game since he came back. But for this entire series, it's just hit by pitch. We hope for better results, and then he keeps getting on base in a less painful way against the White Sox.
Yes, he did not have a hit in any of those games, but was on or a walk in any of those games. But the on base streak continues because he kept getting beaned. Little side note: so he has four hit by a pitch in the last three games. The only two Blue Jays to ever do that prior: Jonathan Davis in 2019, and of course Reed Johnson in 2005. For years, Reed Johnson was the king of getting hit by a pitch. Even led the league 1 year with 21 while he was a Blue Jay. Andrés Giménez has also been hit in three straight games. If he is hit today, he'll tie Leo Jimenez's franchise record with four consecutive games getting hit by a pitch. I looked this up, and this is a deep pull, but this is just the most painful stat I think I've ever looked up. Carlos Quentin was once hit by a pitch in six consecutive games. Not for the Blue Jays, obviously. Carlos Quentin did not play for the Blue Jays, but that's the record. Six games in a row getting beaned.
That's, man. You have to be extremely unlucky, and nothing explains it. Like, you can maybe look at, you know, where a guy is standing. If he's a little too close to home plate or whatever, sure, but you have to be extremely unlucky.
Extremely unlucky to the extent that, like, I think the hit by a pitch guy that recent Blue Jays fans would think of is Danny Jansen. Danny Jansen got hit all the time. He got hit 10 times that one season, and otherwise, I don't think he has a season with more than four hit by a pitch. Like, this is, we think of, oh, that guy's a magnet for getting hit by a pitch. He got 10 over the whole season. Yeah. Carlos Quinn got six games in a row. That's the level. He got hit 23 times that season. He led the league twice in hit by a pitch, Carlos Quinton did. So
we've heard George Springer say a lot this season, I will do whatever it takes to help the team to get on base. Well, don't tell me about that until you've been hit by a pitch in six consecutive games. Then I'll believe you. Then you'll do whatever it takes.
Yeah, get in there, get beaned. Okay, so the Jays lost this one. Other than the bean balls, they did have a little offense going, but it was too little, too late. They got down 9-1. They, you know, John Schneider said after the game, with the way our offense is playing, you don't feel out of it, which is a nice thing. They managed to make it 9-5, at least force the Diamondbacks to use Shelby Miller, just, you know, to make sure, and Alejandro Kirk with a big game. But this one was all about Kevin Gausman and his continued struggles. We talked about a little bit yesterday setting up the game that there were some, you know, not only did he have three, not bad, but less Kevin Gausman-like outings in a row, there was some stuff under the hood with the fastball. And then yesterday, 4 1/3 innings, 7 earned runs, 7 hits, 3 walks, a hit batsman, only 4 strikeouts, only 8 swing and miss for the game. So over his last 4 now, he's only gone 20 innings. He's only gotten out of the 5th inning once. 17 earned runs over those 20 innings, and probably most notable, 12 walks and 2 hit batters. So 14 free passes in 20 innings over there.
Not great. And when you think about, was it last month that he only walked one hitter the entire
over a 4-start stretch, at least. I don't know if it was the whole month, but there was, he had 4-start stretch where with only one walk.
That's what's odd to me, is that, you know, the velocity comes and goes with Gausman's fastball, and that's kind of something that we just have to get used to, I think. Clearly, it wasn't there all the way yesterday. I think it was maybe 94 where he topped out there. Maybe he hit 96 at one point, and I was, you know, kind of, my eyes kind of popped a little bit to see 96 after the 93s, 94s that we were seeing. But it's more than that. It's also location. It's the inability to command. There was a lot of walks, and two, there were a lot of good pitches to hit that weren't touching 97. Is that kind of your perception as
well? Yeah, and first, before I get into that, you were correct. 5 starts over May. So he only walked one batter in all of May and had 4 consecutive walkless starts.
Yeah.
So I was mixing my stats there.
Which is, you know, even more bizarre, but it does seem like it goes back to the command of the fastball a little bit.
Yeah. So there are a few different ways we can look at command. One is just how many strikes you're throwing across all of his pitches. This isn't just the fastball, but he only threw 42% of his pitches in the zone yesterday. That's a season low. He said after June has been ugly for me. So, you know, 42% of pitches in the zone. If the splitter was having like an unbelievable day darting out of the zone, it'd be one thing. But the smoking gun here for me, looking under the hood, is the fastball location, where on the season, 47% of the fastballs he throws are on the edge of the plate. So what that means is within half a ball, kind of strike or ball. The type that maybe it's a called strike, maybe it's a ball, but if you're a hitter, especially with two strikes, you got to offer at it. It's too close not to. And why the edge rate is important is because if you're too far off the edge, then those pitches get a little easier to lay off. And if you are too far inside the edge, those are very hittable fastballs at that point. So 47% on the season, he lives on the edge. That's a really, really good rate. It's why Kevin Gausman's fastball can be so effective at 94, at 95. He did not have a start all season where fewer than 40% of his fastballs were on the edge. Yesterday was 34%. So he just could not find that edge. And what that results in is, again, the fastballs that miss by a lot, nobody's offering at them. He threw 13 that missed the edge to the outside parts of the plate, and the Diamondbacks did not swing at a single one. So all the ones you're missing outside, they're not swinging at. So you're getting into more hitters' counts and things like that. You can't find the edge. So when you have to bring the fastball back in, you're bringing it over the heavier part of the plate, and a guy like Eugenio Suarez can, do some damage on it. Oh, but I guess, yeah, the double was on a slider, but the other two were on fastballs. Yeah. And the homer was on a fastball, at least, that was like on the outer edge, but the single he hit was a fastball, you know, pretty grooved over the middle. So, yeah, a lot there with the fastball location. I know that was a lot of numbers, but basically he can't find the edge. And when he misses outside, they're not offering at it. It's too, whether it's the interplay with the splitter or it's just like you could tell he didn't have his command, they're not offering at anything that misses off the edge in terms of fastball. And then when you come inside, you get hit pretty hard. John Schneider also mentioned that he needs to get in better counts.
Well, one thing's related to the other.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. So prior to the month of June, he'd only spent 15% of the time in hitters' counts. Mm-hmm. That's really good.
Yeah, that is absurdly good.
In June, it's been almost 30%. So he's spending almost twice as much time this month in hitters' counts. That means you're getting behind 2-1 instead of 1-2. You're getting behind 1-0 even. So a lot more time in hitters' counts. And that also means you're less pitch efficient because you're going deeper and deeper into counts. And then they get to see the fastball and the splitter a couple times. So to me, this all comes down to the splitter still had good shape and stuff. It had good depth. It had a lot of that arm side run that he doesn't like as much yesterday, but it still had the good depth. It still got some swing and miss. To me, this is all about the fastball command.
Yeah. And listen, if you can't command the fastball, it's a chain reaction here. If you can't command the fastball, you're going to fall behind in the count, which is something that Gausman usually doesn't do and doesn't like to do. I believe he is still, well, after the way that June has gone, maybe not, but at one point in the season, he was leading the league in first pitch strikes by qualified pitchers. So this is something that he kind of relies on in order to get the fastball and the splitter to work in the way that they do. Well, if you're in a hitter's count and a hitter is not really sure if that's a fastball or a splitter, well, they have the right and the ability to just let that one go. And I think that's what we saw quite a bit of yesterday as well. It's the Diamondbacks, who are one of the best offenses in the league still, even though they, you know, couldn't really find it here for the first two games. They're not going to offer at anything, and they are going to be very, very smart with their swings. This is also a veteran lineup. When you think about, you know, Lourdes Gurriel Jr., Eugenio Suarez himself, Josh Naylor, these guys have been around and they've faced Gausman before. So
was that the Diamondbacks lineup or just my trade deadline shopping list? You want to throw Zach Gallen's name in there too?
Yeah. Well, you know, it can be both for sure. And that all starts with getting ahead in the count. Mm-hmm. If you're not finding the edge, which is what Gausman relies on to get ahead in the count, things are just going to snowball a little bit. The good news is he had done it pretty much the entire season before this awful month started. You have the confidence that Kevin Gausman is going to get it back. And it's just funny that, you know, the splitter wasn't working at first. He just went to the fastball and, you know, delivered some pretty good starts, even though the splitter wasn't working. And well, now the splitter's back.
Yes.
where's the fastball? Once he gets it all to click, then we're going to see prime Kevin Gausman again, and you kind of just hope that it happens at the right time for the Blue Jays to maybe make a run at something more here with the way that the AL East is shaping up.
Yes, and I mean, it's not, I guess it's not a lock that they will line up at the same time, but you certainly hope, look, on a day like yesterday, that you can lean on the splitter a little bit more. But again, the fastball, like, to me, the best indicator of when Kevin Gausman is on, and this is more splitter related, but it's also about the fastball command, is when he steals called strikes at the bottom of the zone with the fastball, because that tells me they're sitting, they're trying to lay off anything low, but he's got the pinpoint command and the tunneling going where even if it's a fastball, they'll lay off it low and he can steal those low strikes. And I know you want to work the fastball up and the splitter down sometimes. You want it to, and Gausman likes to change quadrants and things like that. That's important. But yeah, to me, the called strikes with the fastball is always an interesting indicator of can this team, are they picking up fastball versus splitter? And yeah, that wasn't there yesterday, despite, again, the splitter having good depth and a decent amount of chase on the splitter. They still swung at it outside the zone, I think, on 40% of the splitters that he threw. But
did they have any swings and misses on the fastball yesterday?
I would have to double check.
I don't think not many,
if so.
And that's also a pretty good indicator of how poorly that fastball was moving or being located, right? Because if they're not offering at those borderline pitches outside of the zone, and then you can't locate and you're throwing 94, you're not going to generate swing and miss there either.
Zero whiffs on 13 swings.
Tough.
And like I mentioned earlier, zero chase on 13 fastballs that missed the zone.
Yeah, that's really good. And that is the sign of a good offense, a veteran offense that came in with a game plan.
Sure. But if you have zero chase and zero whiff on, you know, pretty much anything, that's not going to be a great indicator there. So tough one for Gausman. He was pretty hard on himself after, said, not a sharp day for me. He mentioned that his landing leg had been buckling for him a little bit. Certainly you could see kinetic chain wise how that would, you know, affect your command and things like that. He also said everyone did their job in this series and I didn't, and said he was pretty frustrated. So we should mention it was a very windy day. I don't think, like, the metrics are supposed to account for this and stuff. Ryan Nelson didn't have any issue with the wind, so I'm not entirely willing to, you know, it was a windy day. It's tough to control because Ryan Nelson was pinpointing everything at the top of the zone with his fastball.
Yep.
So I don't think that's necessarily an excuse. I could see why it would be an uncomfortable day to pitch in, at least.
Yeah, well, you know, for the Blue Jays, it was also a pretty uncomfortable day to hit against Ryan Nelson. There was nothing going on except for two Alejandro Kirk home runs, and Kirk is a high fastball hitter, so you kind of expect him to deliver a little bit more, both of them to the opposite field, which is a very good sign.
Yeah, the first one off Nelson was fastball up, like you said, right?
Yeah, sorry, but the other one was not against Nelson.
Yeah, it was De Sclafani on a sinker away, but either way.
Yeah, and that's it, right? And when you're locating the fastball up in the zone, it's 96. It's going to be difficult to hit unless you're a hitter who likes to see those. Maybe I was expecting a guy like Ernie Clement to contribute a little bit more. Couldn't get anything done either.
Yeah.
Kind of a tough one. And then, as soon as Nelson came out of the game, then the offense came alive again. It was just a really, really tough day against the starting pitcher.
Yeah, and Nelson was really good. The Kirk stuff is interesting because he gets the oppo homer on the fastball up, and then he gets the, you know, takes one kind of middle away the other way as well, and then the, what did he hit, a double in addition to that? He had another hit in there as well.
He did, it was a single,
A single, and that was on a sinker in. So if you look at, you want to talk about Alejandro Kirk being locked in, and we've talked about this bunch, that's three different quadrants of the zone that he was able to get hits against. One, he pulled. Two, he took the other way. Encouraging stuff there. But yeah, Ryan Nelson, nasty in this one. A little bit of Alejandro Kirk also threw out a runner, I should mention.
Kirk game, 100%.
Yeah, if they had won that game, we're leading with Kirk and we're talking mostly Kirk.
I got to say, it's a good sign because he had been in a little bit of a slump since destroying everything.
He's not getting to two strikes enough. He's getting hits too early in the count.
Yeah, but you kind of want to see a guy who has been that important sort of come alive a little bit again, and you know, two home runs, that's going to bode well for you for sure, especially against a lesser team and the White Sox coming in. If Kirk can bottle up some of that and just continue to swing the bat well, and as well as he did in this last game, then you're kind of a little better than you were before, but yeah, it's still a pretty frustrating day no matter how you slice it.
Yeah, and if you look at the specifics of how Ryan Nelson got to them with that fastball up in the zone, Davis Martin is like, approach-wise, like kind of a poor man's Ryan Nelson. He has more pitches that he can junk it up with, but he wants to throw a lesser fastball up in the zone a ton. So they're going to see, they won't see 96, 97
right.
up in the zone, but they'll probably see a lot of 94 up in the zone today. So who knows? Maybe it'll be a good day you're geared up for. You just saw a similar approach yesterday. There's also a funny thing going. So Nelson has, in general, he has one of the highest rise fastballs. So a fastball that doesn't drop as much as you would expect. And according to the StatCast data, he had like one of the most incredible fastball rise games of all time yesterday. Like Nick Pivetta is the king of this stuff. And Ryan Nelson's game yesterday was more rise on the fastball than even Nick Pivetta right. gets. Torey Lovullo after the game was like, I don't think so.
I think so.
Maybe there was a calibration issue. So I won't reference those stats specifically. We don't care that much about the difference between 22 and 23 inches of rise on right. the fastball. You know, that's too granular anyway, other than to say it's up and rises a lot. That's enough for us.
Right.
But yeah, it was funny to have Torey Lovullo like have the stats handy after the game and be like, yeah, I don't think so.
Nah. And it's funny because sometimes, you know, with lesser things, with things that are maybe, I shouldn't say lesser, but maybe more front facing, we have seen StatCast game day or whatever it is come back and just readjust
yeah.
or correct
yeah.
some things.
Is that a sinker or a weird fastball?
Yes.
Are Chris Bassett's cutters or are they just four seamers that have a little more ride to them?
I'd be curious to see if this is one that they maybe revise a little bit because, listen, I know that we're not blaming the wind for anything here, but it was crazy windy yesterday. Mm-hmm. It was wild. I couldn't
all my
believe
balcony
that the roof
furniture
was
blew over.
Yeah. And you're not even that high up.
I'm on the 21st floor. That's pretty high up.
You're on the 21st floor.
You have been in my apartment.
I know. Well,
I'm on the 21st floor, well, yeah.
Okay. That tells you how much attention I am paying to everything. You have a cat, though, in my defense. So, I, you know, if I'm there, I'm playing with the cat.
Yeah,
we all know that.
Sure. Sure. Until next weekend when I have the best vantage point of the festivities in the city. You just
yeah.
sit out there. You just sit out there with a cocktail and
yep.
watch without being in the middle of it.
I may text you, actually, because yeah. I will be... Oh, again, I can't obviously tell people where you live.
I mean, people have a
I'll
sense
be nearby.
Of, yeah, people have a sense of what area we're talking about. Okay, as we turn the page to today, couple of updates. Nathan Lucas played in another AAA game yesterday. He was the designated hitter. Sounds like he'll be back today. They didn't say for sure, but he got another hit yesterday. Designated hitter, everything went well in left field the day before. It seems like he'll be ready to go. It creates an interesting question in terms of who goes down. Will Robertson was last man up. So if we're going, you know, inventory wise, if you are working retail, Will Robertson's the guy that goes. Alan Roden was a late scratch yesterday with knee inflammation. He was available as a reserve, so doesn't sound like an IL thing's happening. Miles Straw sounded better yesterday with the ankle sprain. I guess technically they could IL him if they think he's going to need a couple extra days. So those are your options there. John Schneider got asked kind of about this and said there's a competition for sure for a few guys. And I think you would include David Schneider, Will Wagner at AAA if they have to swap out an outfielder for an infielder at some point. Addison Barger's probably played his way out of that competition. And then the other name is Jonathan Clase, who homered yesterday.
Yeah.
Also had some it was a windy day, but he had some interesting routes in center field.
Yep. Well, I mean, he didn't make any faux pas, right?
He almost did on that sack fly. Where like we just couldn't tell if
right.
he trapped it or not. He got there in time. But John Schneider even said after the game that like his speed helps him make up for some stuff. The home run potential where he has hit 20 homers in the minors before, you know, you can live with some of the chase because of the home run potential. Basically, when we're talking about all these guys, a lot of them are older prospects and they're like high floor. Maybe the ceiling's not crazy high, Barger excluded.
Yep.
But then Clase is younger and the floor is lower, but the ceiling's higher. So John Schneider didn't use it in those words, but he kind of acknowledged that when we're talking about all these guys and we're evaluating these guys, Clase is kind of his own thing off
right.
to the side, given the age and upside.
That's really fascinating. And when he had a big game during the road trip, Schneider said something like brimming with potential or
mm-hmm.
something like that. He used words like that. And the main word there was potential. I would say that we have seen Jonathan Clase do a little bit more than he had been in order to stick around. The home run was, I don't know if the wind helped him there too, but that was gone.
Yeah.
That was it was absurd. And you kind of forget that he has that type of pop in his bat because he hasn't really shown it all that much up to this point here in Toronto or in the major leagues. The speed does make up for a lot. I will say that in center field, he's also looked a little bit better than I expected him to. But that needs to be continuous. The growth needs to be continuous. And that is up to the player, 100%. I believe that Jonathan Clase will stay up here for as long as he is putting in the work and showing that growth. We understand that it's not linear. We don't expect him to hit a home run that goes farther today, right? But in order to have those markers and those points that you can turn to and say, okay, this is clearly him turning a corner. This is clearly him learning something about his swing, about himself, about playing in the outfield, then I think he's good. But you're right in that we don't know who is going to get sent down mm-hmm. once Nathan Lucas comes back. I would say Will Robertson is a pretty good bet, but I wouldn't exclude Alan Roden and Davis Schneider from this conversation just yet.
Yeah, especially with, in Davis Schneider's case, if you were picking between him and Will Robertson, obviously Davis Schneider is one of the only extra infield capable guys that they have, but they are about to see a bunch more righties in a row too. So, are there enough pinch hit opportunities? Is there a spot to start and things like that? Clase, even after the home run yesterday, a sub 500 OPS for June with a 32% strikeout rate. So
the strikeouts to me are the biggest thing.
Yeah.
That needs to improve. And he is chasing. He's swinging at pitches he shouldn't be swinging at. That to me is the number one thing of like, if you want to stick around, this is what you need to work on.
He hit that home run, by the way, off Anthony DeSclafani, who if you are a person like me who is a giant nerd and likes to open up a baseball reference page and just click around, Anthony DeSclafani has one of the best in the biz because he has been a part of some very, very big trades. Obviously, as a Blue Jays prospect, sixth round pick, then a part of the big Emilio Bonifacio, John Buck, Mark Burley, Josh Johnson, Jose Reyes trade from 2012. The Marlins then turned around and traded him in a package for Matt Latos, who was very, very good at one point. He became a free agent, signed with the Giants. The Giants traded him as part of a package for Robbie Ray. Mm-hmm. He was then traded by the Mariners as part of a package for Jorge Polanco. So Polanco, Robbie Ray, Matt Latos, Josh Johnson, Mark Burley, Jose Reyes, Emilio Bonifacio, yeah. John Buck.
What do they all have in common, Anthony DeSclafani?
Yeah, absolutely. He's been traded for some guys.
Dang, that's crazy.
The other update for today's game as we look
at... Sorry, that was a journey. I'm still getting over
it. It's a lot of guys.
That was a lot. That was just a history lesson in baseball trades. Thank you for that.
Yeah, that's I love to click on guy. I love to not even remember some guys, like just click around on guys as well. Thank you to Luis Gonzalez for broadcasting this game. I was clicking around his page the other day for a while too. Spencer Turnbull will start tonight. He can probably go up to 80-ish pitches. It sounds like he threw 51 in his last mop-up. He had thrown gotten up to 80 in a AAA start. So this isn't going to be, 100 pitches. And even if he gets to 80, it probably means things have gone pretty well. Paxton Schultz and Justin Brule covered 4 1/3 yesterday. So shout out to them. They did that on just 58 combined pitches. Really saved the bullpen for today because 6 guys are probably green today in the bullpen, which is a big help. I could still see a roster move happening there to get one more fresh arm since Schultz is a length guy and pitched a lot yesterday. Brule pitched back-to-back days and is obviously he just got called up. The thing to note, though, is there are no healthy pitchers on the 40-man. Mm-hmm. Adam Macko, you could, but I think he's enough of a starting pitching prospect that you wouldn't call him up for bullpen depth for like one day. But Easton Lucas is hurt. Jake Blas is hurt. None of the rehabbing guys seem imminent, although Nick Sandlin was in the clubhouse the other day getting checked on, and they were still deciding if he was going to do one more Buffalo appearance. Neither he nor Ryan Burr appeared in games yesterday, so that'd be interesting to see how that one plays out. What do you think? Spencer Turnbull getting the, we knew he was going to get the nod when the Bowden Francis stuff happened, but are you looking 80 pitches? Are you looking like 3 innings and then turn it over to a bullpen? How do you think they handle this one?
Yeah, I think first time through the order and you kind of go from there is the best way to approach this one. Just, this is kind of what I would be looking at. Having a pitch count to sort of aim for is good. But we still don't know. There's been nothing spectacular. There's been nothing inherently bad or, you know, worrying about the way that Turnbull has pitched so far. There has been nothing spectacular. The good news is that this offense is also not spectacular, and
yes.
So maybe you can work something out there. It's a good way to get a first start after coming back and pitching in relief for a couple of outings here. Yeah,
I'd say number 28 offense. Yeah.
Yeah, first time through the order. And then you reevaluate. But
you
yeah.
can't let him face Mike Tauchman a second time.
A second time, that could be the last straw for
yeah.
sure.
Look, yeah. Look, any offense is capable of putting up a big number. So I'm, you know, being a little tongue in cheek here. But yeah, they're the number 28 offense by runs per game and pretty much all the underlying metrics. They do walk a lot, but they don't hit for power. They don't really steal bases. For a very young team, they're like middle of the league in stolen bases. If I was a young team, I'd just be go.
Yeah, for sure.
Go.
I mean,
Chase Medroth,
might
go.
As well. But yeah, listen, it's the Blue Jays have found a lot of success with these guys that they bring up, and you don't really expect much from them, and then all of a sudden they're Eric Lauer or whatever. Mm. So that is a good sign. The Blue Jays are clearly doing a good job with these pitchers. We'll see what Turnbull can do.
Yeah, I just saw that Vlad and Lourdes did a jersey swap yesterday, which
That's
is
cute.
Very cute as well. We won't talk about the first pitches that got thrown yesterday. We don't want to be negative about our battles. We will take a break, though. On the other side, we'll talk to Jorge Castillo of ESPN. We'll check in on those New York teams who both had bad weeks. We'll talk to James Fagan at 11 o'clock to get the lay of the land for this White Sox team. We'll talk to Michelle Seniak of the Blue Jays about their pride night tonight. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL.
The J.D. Bunkin Podcast.
Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Later in the show, I'll give out my social insurance number since I gave out so many details about where I live and other things in that first segment.
We don't even know your first name. It's
yeah,
fine.
Not my government name. No. Look, Jays get in action against the White Sox tonight. It starts at 7:07 down at Rogers Center. They will try to continue their ascent in the American League East. They've made up 5 games in the division over the last 3.5 weeks. That's in part because the New York Yankees have been struggling. Let's talk about it. Let's talk to Jorge Castillo of ESPN. He joins us now. Jorge, good morning, man. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing well. How are you guys?
Pretty good over here, man. Yankees snapped the losing streak yesterday, 7-3 win against the Angels to avoid the sweep. What's the last week or so been like around that team? And, I mean, I can't imagine you thought you'd be writing too many where the heck is the offense, given how Aaron Judge started this season.
Yeah, it depends on how closely around the team are we talking about. We're talking about New York City. Are we talking about the clubhouse? Like, you know, because
New York City
outside,
is what I'm most fascinated in.
Yeah, you know, people, you know how it is. People tend to overreact to small samples. I know the phrase small sample is used a lot, but, you know, this is an offense that until that rough patch that started like last Wednesday, Thursday, was the best offense in the American League. Now, you could say that that's because Aaron Judge was the best hitter we've seen in you know, since Bonds, and that wasn't sustainable, sure. But they had other guys who were really playing well, Trent Grisham, Ben Rice, Paul Goldschmidt, Cody Bellinger. All those guys at the same time kind of cooled off, and, you know, New York City couldn't quite handle it. I think they'll be fine. You know, they have guys in there, former MVPs, you know, all-stars and all that. And Aaron Judge, to me, is the best hitter in the world. I think they'll be fine. Now, you do have to wonder if they rely too much on Aaron Judge, who has struggled as of late before breaking out a bit yesterday. But I think the Yankees will be fine. But there's some competition in the American League East. You guys said it. The Toronto Blue Jays have made up ground, and the Tampa Bay Rays have been playing really, really good ball. So this is not going to be the Yankees coasting to the division title.
Yeah, it seems like we were running out of adjectives for Aaron Judge with the way that the season started. And I don't think anyone doubts that he's going to be fine. I mean, he is Aaron Judge, and you look at yesterday's game, it's like, yeah, he's going to be fine. But what did you see during this mini slump that he was in for the Yankees?
He was chasing a little more. Not a little more, significantly more than he usually does, or at least that he was the first couple of months of the season when he was a sort of a robot. He just kind of proved that he's kind of human. He was striking out a lot, you know, a few games there in a row where he struck out 3 times. You know, he had that big home run at Fenway Park against Crochet in the ninth inning last week. But other than that, it was struggle city for Aaron Judge. And, you know, I think, him, you know, expecting him to sustain what he was doing, it just wasn't realistic. I know we love talking about the 400, Ted Williams. That was never going to happen. Hitting nowadays is harder than ever, you know, and there were numbers that supported the fact that what he was doing the first few months of the season was more impressive than what Ted Williams did when he hit 406. Mm-hmm. So that to me was never sustainable. Aaron Judge has gotten, you know, a little out of his, out of sorts right now. He's chasing a little bit. I think he's going to, you know, get back on track and start hitting again. Now, I do wonder a little bit more about, you know, Trent Grisham, Ben Rice, Paul Goldschmidt, who's 37 years old. Can Cody Bellinger kind of get back to what he was doing? Those are the question marks I really have. Aaron Judge will be fine.
Yeah, Aaron Judge, even after the 2-for-22 stretch, kicking with almost 1,200 OPS. He'll be all right. The other name that factors into this, and you wrote about him for ESPN the other day, Giancarlo Stanton is back, and he's 35. I don't think anyone expects Giancarlo Stanton to be Giancarlo Stanton of old. He'll probably still pop the Statcast number every so often here. But what can that do in terms of just like lengthening the lineup a little bit behind Aaron Judge?
Yeah, I forget who said this the other day post game, but he is like an uncomfortable at bat just because he just might hit the ball really hard, like at you. You know, the guy feels like, you know, he hits the ball like over 100 miles an hour. You see the Statcast stuff. That stuff is very real. His first hit of the season was like 111.1 miles per hour as a line drive to left field. He hits the ball hard, and he's a big dude. You know, he's a scary at bat, right? It's a scary person to face. Now, you know, I don't think the Yankees expect, you know, this Giancarlo Stanton of old that was on a Hall of Fame track, that he's not the guy anymore. That's not him anymore. He's a guy who's dealing with, you know, various injuries, obviously, over the last few years. What he dealt with this year in terms of the reason why he made his debut this week was he has like elbow pain in his tendons and his elbows, both of them. And he was dealing with that all last season. And he still did his thing in the postseason, having, you know, 7 home runs in the 14 playoff games. I just think the Yankees, you know, he lengthens the lineup. He provides some power, more power. And I think the Yankees, ultimately, they just want him healthy for October, because this guy, for some reason, in October, he turns it up. He becomes old Giancarlo Stanton, and that's the player the Yankees are sort of looking for. Obviously, you have to get to October 1st. But I think at this point, what they're going to do is mix and match. They kind of have a surplus of players right now between DH, first base, outfield. Aaron Boone has some decisions to make every single day. And Giancarlo Stanton's going to play a lot, not every single day. And the Yankees just want to make sure he stays healthy.
Yeah, listen, the more power part of what you said is really what sticks out to me here, because sometimes, and we've had other conversations with in this show with other guests, and it's like, maybe the Yankees are a little too reliant on the home run ball, and then when that goes away, that's kind of what you see from the offense. Is that a fair assessment? Is it a little overly simplistic, Jorge?
I think it's fair, especially, you know, people, let's say you sit down and watch the Yankees play, and you see them hitting home runs, and the other day that you see them, they can't put down a bunt. That's a fair assessment. Now, I think, you know, their situational hitting, their inability, like I just alluded to put down a bunt. Trent Grisham couldn't put down a bunt the other day. DJ LeMahieu couldn't do it. That's an issue. They've been running into the outs. There was one time this week where Trent Grisham literally ran into the ball when he was running to second base. You can't be doing that. So there are things, and we saw last year in the World Series, and that was my big thing last year when I was, you know, going into the postseason. I was like, this team is super talented. You know, their top end talent, Juan Soto, Aaron Judge, Gerrit Cole, is among the best. Their issue was fundamentals. Their issue was, smart base running, playing sound, good defense, not spectacular, just sound fundamental defense. And that cost them in the World Series. I think they're better at that this year, but we saw this week, there are times when this team can make some mistakes and it can cost them. And when you're not hitting, that's all magnified, right? And I think in October, again, that becomes magnified. I think this team is better than last year's team at that, but I think they still have some improvements to make.
Yeah, that Anthony Volpe error on Joe Adell's at bat comes to mind when you're talking about sound fundamental baseball here.
Yeah, well, look, Joe Adell's an intimidating guy too, just like Giancarlo Stanton. You've got to be on your toes. Jorge, on the other side, so the Yankees, they weren't hitting, and I understand they lost a bunch of games, but the pitching has actually done its job to keep them in a lot of these games. 10 consecutive games where they haven't allowed more than 4 runs. Will Warren and Clark Schmidt in particular kind of stabilizing a rotation that had lost Luis Gil, lost Gerrit Cole, still hasn't had Marcus Stroman back. What have you seen from Warren and Schmidt in terms of just locking things up the last couple times through the rotation?
Yeah, they're both guys on slightly different timelines, right? Clark Schmidt's been around for a few years now, but he was a top prospect for the Yankees. He has great stuff. He's sort of figuring things out. Last year, he missed some time, and that kind of interrupted his season. But he had a pretty good season last year when he was on the field. Will Warren is a guy who last year just did not look like he was ready. Well, he wasn't ready for the major leagues in his brief time there. This year, he's attacking the zone. He had a career high 11 strikeouts the other day. His four seam is just a quality pitch right now, that because he says he just just attacking with them. He's just going at them. His stuff. He believes in his stuff. And I think that's been the biggest key for Will Warren. And those two guys, there were question marks a bit to a certain extent, right? Clark Schmidt less though, but Will Warren is in the starting rotation because, like you said, Garrett Cole got hurt for the season. Luis Hill has not pitched yet this year. And we all sort of wondered, hey, is Will Warren ready to take that next step? And when he has his stuff working, when he's attacking the strike zone, he strikes out a bunch of guys. He leads all rookies, I believe, in strikeouts this season. And, it's been super important for the Yankees to have that. It's not just the Max Fried and Carlos Rodon show. You need those other guys in the rotation. And Ryan Yarbrough hasn't really been, as good as he was early on in May. But he's also been a revelation for the Yankees in terms of just getting through the stretch until Luis Hill comes back. Marcus Stroman might come back until they can fill this thing out. Maybe they go out and get somebody before the trade deadline. But for now, the Yankees pitching staff, the bullpen as well, Devin Williams has sort of bounced back. It's been great, and it's really helped them, during this stretch here, even though they haven't won too many games. The games have been close because the pitching staff's pitching so well.
Some losses on the bullpen side as well recently, and now we may be talking about Luke Weaver coming back way sooner than he was supposed to. Can you tell us a bit about that, the reasoning behind it, and just, I guess, your take on this whole conversation?
Yeah, so he said this week, he threw a live BP, simulated four outs, an up and a down, so like an inning and a third, simulating that experience in full uniform at Yankee Stadium. And he said, I just haven't felt any pain since I did it. He's like, I was sore the day or two after. But I think, the Yankees have just been like, this isn't as bad as we thought it was going to be. I feel good. I've been throwing. No issues at all. I did my live BP. I'm fine. I'm not going to waste my bullets in another live BP or a rehab assignment when I'm a reliever. Let's just go do it right now in a real game. And that's ultimately it. I know the projection earlier was 4 to 6 weeks. This will be around three weeks. So it's a big deal for the Yankees. Obviously, you hope if you're the Yankees that you're not rushing this. But from all accounts, it sounds like Luke Weaver just had that initial hamstring pain and is good. And the question now becomes, is he the closer again? Or is that Devin Williams' job? Because Devin Williams has been really good over the last month and a half, really. So, that's a question we asked Aaron Boone this week. He said he hadn't made a decision yet. I expect Devin Williams to be the closer. I think ultimately the Yankees' bullpen is at its best. You optimize that group when Luke Weaver can come out of the bullpen in a fireman situation or just to throw multiple innings. This is a guy who was a former starter until last year, so maybe he can take down – three, four, five, six outs, and then Devin Williams is a one-inning guy.
Yeah, and we see you talked earlier about the small ball value in the playoffs. The value of Weaver in that role come playoff time is so immense, as we saw from the Tigers and other teams last year. Jorge, so the Yankees avoid the sweep, but the Angels took three off of them. We also saw the Angels take three off the Dodgers. They took a couple off the Blue Jays. They're hanging around 500. I know they're probably not enough to get into the back end of that wild card conversation. But what did you see from them? It seems like they're not nearly as bad as maybe we expected the first couple weeks of the season.
Yeah, I still can't believe that they're this good. It's not me throwing shade. I just, you don't really have high expectations for the Angels, just given how, their recent history. But Ron Washington, has them playing good ball. They're like a plucky group. And it's weird saying that because they have guys with first round picks, Zach Nato and Charnel and Mike Trout's on that team. I know we've forgotten about Mike Trout. He's still on the team and he's playing. Joe Adele, you mentioned intimidating. I think he leads the majors in home runs over the last 20 games or so, 20 days. So they have some talent. Now, I don't expect him to stick around in this race. Now, the question is, if they do stick around, do you you know, if you're hovering around 500 and you're like, yeah, this is a solid chance, this is a very good chance we're not going to make the playoffs, whatever. There's a 25% chance we make it, 20% chance. Do you add? Do you stay? Do you stick with what you have? Or do you sell? You know, there comes a point where you want the Zach Nados in the world and the Sean Nels and Joe Adels to learn how to finish out a season, to be in a race, to have important games in September. I think that's important for team culture. Yeah, as you build this thing and, you know, maybe next year you add two, you know, maybe contend for a wild card spot. That's a question because they have guys there. They have Kenley Jansen who they could trade, or, you know, Moncada who they can trade at the deadline. They have different pieces, Tyler Anderson, who could, you know, get decent hauls at the trade deadline from contenders. I just wonder, you know, if they hover around this, you know, sort of 500 range, how aggressive that front office gets and what their objective is.
Yeah, the Angels always seem to be an interesting team around the trade deadline, because either because they're out of it or because they're kind of in it, and then they're going to do something a little crazy, right? We never really know what to expect, which is, I don't know, it does make it fun. But as they leave New York here, we do turn our attention to the Mets, who are also in a bit of a slump here, six games in a row now. First of all, important to have, you know, banked that many wins early in the season, because the Phillies are here now, but the Mets are still in relatively good place. But Jorge, the question is the pitching, right? Especially the starting pitching, which was such a strength for them. And now Kodai Senga is on the IL. Tyler McGill is hurt. How do they sort of, I guess, withstand these injuries?
Yeah, the rotation for the first couple of months of the season, I mean, I think it still has. I haven't looked at the numbers as of now, but as of this week, they had the top rotation ERA in baseball, right? And when you saw this rotation going into the season, you were like, this is a huge question mark. Why didn't they go get Max Fried or Corbin Burns or Blake Snell? Why, quote unquote, settle for Sean Manaea, Griffin Kidd, and Clay Holmes, who was a closer for years? And what they did the first couple of months was amazing. That's the best staff ERA in baseball, rotation ERA in baseball for a while. So now we're seeing some cracks. McGill's hurt, as you said. Senga's hurt again. And Sean Manaea should be coming off the injury list here soon. Frankie Montas, it sounds like he's coming off the injury list. He's a guy they also signed 2 years, $34 million over the offseason. The problem with Frankie Montas is he hasn't pitched yet this season. He got rocked on his rehab assignment. Pretty much, you know, his last three or four starts just got rocked. So it'll be interesting to see how he looks like, how he looks when he's at the major league level. Maybe the Mets can kind of identify something and he can get going for him. But they need Montas and Manaea to come in and be good. You know, they need Sean Manaea to be Sean Manaea. That's why they gave him 3 years, $75 million. That's really that's the ace of this staff, this rotation. So we are seeing cracks. I do wonder about the bullpen too. You know, it got, while this rotation has been really good early on, guys like Clay Holmes and Kodai Senga and McGill, they weren't going deep into games. So you were relying on this bullpen a lot. And now you got AJ Minter, you know, out for the season. I think ultimately the Mets need to add to that bullpen. Right now, the pitching staff to me is a huge question mark, and the offense needs to step up.
Yeah, it's well said. And yes, they are still first in rotation ERA and staff ERA. I double checked it there. Normally, I don't care about rehab assignment results. And then I looked at just how bad it's been for Frankie Montas. And yeah, 12.05 ERA over six minor league rehab starts. That's ugly there. Jorge, man, thanks so much for doing this. Really appreciate it. Keep up all the great work.
I appreciate it, guys. Thanks for having me.
Jorge Castillo of ESPN. Check him out for Yankees. I almost said Knicks. Yankees stuff, Mets stuff. Yeah.
Close enough.
Yeah. The other thing we could have asked him about, because, you know, AL East guy, Red Sox sending Christian Campbell down in the wake of the Rafael Devers trade. He has obviously not been very good. He's been getting subbed out of a lot of games for defense replacement or situational stuff. But in an era where you just traded Rafael Devers and called up Roman Anthony and Marcelo Meyer, a little weird optically, yeah, to send Christian Campbell back down. He also has that $60 million contract. Lots of time to figure it out and return value on that contract, but yeah.
Yeah, it's really just another move that will bank you more wins than if you didn't make it. We'll see how that one goes. It's unfortunate. It's weird to see the Red Sox kind of spiral like this, because, you know, they looked pretty good and they looked exciting and fun, and people were picking them to win the division before the season started. And here we are. I don't know. It kind of puts things in perspective a little bit. And also, it's, to me, the way I look at it, as nothing is bad enough that it can't get worse. So,
oof.
we'll see. We'll see what keeps happening over there in Boston, but it's a weird time for sure.
Yeah, that is that's a tough phrasing. Things are never so bad that they can't get worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry about that.
I thought my most depressing one, like when I did the lyric openers, was things get better, but they never get good. but that's right. That might get bumped by things are never so bad that they can't get worse. Willie Abreu, by the way, we expect the corresponding move for Christian Campbell. So that's why the Red Sox had a crunch. Interesting to see it shake down like that. Only other note from me before we take a break and talk to James Fagan and get set for the White Sox side of the series. Today is the summer solstice. It's the most daylight we get of any day this year. Hopefully the sun's actually out. I can't see from in our
studio
here.
Hopefully the roof is open because I will have to be there.
I think it's supposed to rain because, again, I have outdoor concert tickets, so I'm very aware of the weather forecast. Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah, things are never so bad that they can't get worse. Hopefully they get better for the Toronto Blue Jays when they face the Chicago White Sox starting tonight for a 3-set. Let's take a break. Let's learn about the White Sox on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. It'll be Spencer Turnbull against Davis Martin tonight. Jose Berríos against Aaron Civale, the newest White Sox, on Saturday. And then Chris Bassett against TBD on Sunday. We'll see what the White Sox are up to. Let's get to know those White Sox a little bit. They've lost 8 in a row, even with the Pope in their corner. James Fagan of Sox Machine, Baseball America, and Fangraphs joins us now. James, how's it going, man?
I'm all right. I can solve one mystery. Adrian Hauser will come off the paternity list and start Sunday for the White Sox.
That is, I did have that in my notes to ask you. I just wasn't 1,000% sure if that was the game plan there. So thank you for that. We're off to a great start.
Yeah, right away. James, my first question to you is this. How many times have you been asked about the Pope being a White Sox fan?
Not that often.
Really?
I think it's Well, no one cares what I think about it. I think more it's like, does Chris Getz think like his moves are like sanctified now? Or the players, do they care? They all got a bunch of like Pope Leo t-shirts that they like work out in now. They seem like, oh, that's the thing that's happening. I more like for me, it's like, I've got a lot of people suggesting, like, do you think he knows who you are? does he, like, agree with, like, takes that you've made? Which, sure, I hope so that he knows who I am, if only because, like, the cachet I'd get from my mother-in-law would just be, like, unparalleled.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Sox Machine subscriber Pope Leo would be a great handle there. Pope stuff aside, it's also been a busy couple weeks anyway for covering the White Sox because of the reports about potential changes in ownership and how that might affect the regional sports deals and things like that. I know you wrote about it a couple weeks ago for Sox Machine, but can you give us kind of a high level, how are you feeling about the kind of future of the Chicago White Sox fan franchise at this point in time?
It's very like things might get better at some point down the road, eventually, sort of like, you know, where there's this one, obviously the soonest it can happen is, you know, 4 years from now. And then there's this indefinite range. And it's really kind of setting like a legal framework for Jerry Reinsdorf to turn over the team, either obviously when he passes or, you know, when he decides he doesn't want to do it anymore. It kind of puts it in this bucket with him being 89 years old, where they kind of gave like this weird guesstimate of where like the transfer power would happen organically, or kind of gives them a window of when they want to. So, but as far as like, you know, the press release had notes about immediate capital infusions. And I think that, you know, provided some excitement that this would be, you know, cause this is running like, you know, the lowest payroll in the American League right now on top of the other shortcomings. And the response I got was more like, it's more like we're paying off like existing debt for the franchise or other stuff, and not like, oh, we're in play for Kyle Tucker this winter now. So I think people are like, the idea that a transfer might happen at some point is exciting, but as far as like immediate impacts, you know, I feel like that's been kind of pushed back on, that we should expect them to operate in some new different way. Even their, you know, cable deal, because they got their regional sports provider probably finally put on like the main cable provider in the region, that's more like thank goodness we can stop losing money as opposed to like, now our ship's really come in.
So you're not going to get to stop referring to the player development side of things as a boutique approach and an artisanal player development system. You're going to lose those. You're not going to lose those adjectives, rather.
I think they're still going with small but mighty as their rallying cry for the player development operation.
Perfect.
It's funny because at one point in this season, as the Colorado Rockies spiraled, the White Sox didn't look as bad. They were also winning some games and putting together something to make people excited about. That hasn't been the case of late. It has not been the case of late. It's an 8-game skid. What are you seeing? Is this just a product of youth right now, and you kind of have to go through these low points in the season?
They can't hit. That's kind of the main issue. Luis Robert was supposed to be kind of the, big piece in the lineup and is, sub 600 OPS. Andrew Vaughn batted cleanup a lot early this season. He's on the Milwaukee AAA affiliate right now. They were already going to be a weak offensive team. And you've seen like their main tent poles kind of fall apart. Maybe the biggest offensive infusion they were supposed to get, from their youth was, their top prospect, Colson Montgomery, or at least he was supposed to be major league ready or even compete for a spring training job, hit so poorly in the first month that they took him to Arizona to work on mechanics. He's been a bit better since, but as far as like expecting a big offensive infusion at some point, what they thought was stable has, fallen off. And, the guys who have been contributing are kind of more like we're supposed to be complementary pieces to their offense at some point. Like Chase Meidroff has been at the top of their lineup and getting on base a lot, but it was someone who was like, restricted in terms of how much power output he has, was kind of seen as like a really high order utility player. He's played good enough to be like a regular minor infield guy, but it's not someone like, it's not fair to task him with carrying the offense now that he's going through a little bit of a down period. Like, they pulled up their two top prospect catchers, Edgar Caro and Kyle Teal. And, there's a lot of optimism about them hitting well for catchers, but, they're the two youngest catchers in the sport. They're going through the adjustment phase of their own. They don't have like somebody who has 1,000 OPS and AAA that they're going to call up at some point. They don't have a Jack Caglione type of injections of this offense. So it was really a group that was going to kind of have to piece it together and doesn't even have as much as they thought they would to do that.
Obviously, the catcher position, the attrition rate is high, and even if you're a full-time guy, you might only play 100 games. But when you see Teal and Caro come up together at that young age and splitting the catcher and a little bit of DH work here, would you like? Are you looking at that, or are they looking at that more as that's a competition or a compliment? Like those two are going to be a tandem rather than fighting for the kind of C1 spot.
It's a little undecided. Sometimes they talk about it like it can work as a tandem. I certainly think it's kind of like the modern look of teams that you really need two catchers you can rely on. I don't think that we really see guys like catching 130, 140 games anymore for a playoff contender. I think that's a little bit 10 years ago. But at the same time, at some points, they kind of indicate that they prefer Teal. And I think with his power production, there's probably a bit more of an offensive ceiling. Same time, Edgar Caro beat him to the majors despite being a year younger. He does a lot of things well. He gets on base. He has a clearly defined hit tool. So it's not necessarily closed discussion like who is the better one. And I think there's certainly a rule for a productive team to run two and use them both pretty regularly. Same time, they're a team with a lot of needs. They need a lot more offense in other parts of their system, both presently and long term. We don't know when Ishpia's rolling in and making this a team that runs a regular budget. So could they trade one of them down the road for filling in a need? Quite easily, because they have needs that are going to emerge up. So right now, it's going to be a pretty even split, and you're going to see them a lot in the lineup, and one of them pitching and DHing probably at least once, if not twice, this series. But it's a little bit of a uncertain. Yeah, but that's the nature of everything White Sox. So there's no firm place to set your feet.
I will warn the White Sox that if you trade away a catching prospect, even if the guy you choose to keep is really, really good and the guy you get back is really good, fans will never stop talking about trading away a Gabriel Moreno, for example, even if Alejandro Kirk and Dalton Barshow are pretty good. James, so you mentioned Medroth there, and Teal is obviously a part of the Garrett Crochet package as well. Braden Montgomery up to high A and killing it, and then Wilkelman Gonzalez at AAA kind of iffy. When you look at Teal's here, Medroth has maybe overperformed expectations so far. Montgomery looks like a future piece. How do you kind of feel about the Crochet return a few months removed from it now?
It's running solid. It's certainly, I think it's their best of their trades that they've made, you know, their rebuild trade, so to speak, which was, you know, Dylan Cease, spring of 2024. That one is really troubled. You know, Eric Fetty, Michael Kobach, Tommy Pham deal midseason last year. That one was just pilloried initially, but Miguel Vargas turning around and, you know, looking like, you know, on this team, he's like batting cleanup or third every single day. He's looking more like a solid regular, at least. So that one's kind of turning. But like the Crochet trade is the one that got immediately from like the industry, like the best response, and I think has the most depth in terms of like multiple pieces here looking like they could be, you know, multi-year contributors. So I think it's kind of backing at what at least they're saying is like, all right, we've been incorporating more data. We've been modernizing these past like year, 18 months, and you're seeing our work get better and better. And I think Crochet is kind of their flag on that. But one, they don't have as many good trade pieces anymore. And two, like, you know, kind of some of the big bullets they fired before that, we don't know if they've returned anything that's really star level as a response.
James, just going back to the two rookie catchers really quickly, I'm wondering, there's probably a ton of perils in having two rookie catchers in your team. And I know you wrote about sort of what the White Sox want to see from each of these guys defensively. Can you expand a little bit on that and what you have seen from a team that has two very, very young catchers on the roster?
Well, certainly like pitch calling is something that they're both like adapting to. I think there's a little bit of aid to it because pitchers have their own pitch com now. So this, like, certainly veteran starters like a Davis Martin, for example, pretty much calls the majority of his own game. And I think it's been able to help them along. But, you know, the one kind of tangible thing you can look at is their pitch framing. And Edgar Caro, I think, was like bottom of the league for how many, you know, pitches he's caught. Like there's some little used national catchers below him or something like that. But they've both been like in the bottom half of the league. Teal's a little bit higher, and that's why Teal's been starting more. But that's something that they view as kind of a work in progress. And, you know, I've been seeing them kind of tick up over the course of, you know, the weeks that they've been here. But it's a big emphasis that, you know, they talked about in spring of trying to no longer be an org that, you know, kind of wave their hand at framing a little bit and go like really invested in it and treat it as like the central value for catchers. And yes, this is a little ironic that this is their big update when, you know, whenever we talk about catch framing at this point, it's like, will it go away with ABS? And they're trying to like go invest in it, right, as it might slip away. But it's kind of the area where they see the potential to these guys to do it because they're, you know, certainly Teal's pretty athletic and Caro's, you know, low to the ground. He should be able to get low strikes, but they're still kind of growing in that aspect. And for a pitching staff that's, you know, been middle of the pack, but doesn't have strikeout stuff, really needs to like get everything they need on the margins. It's definitely a calculated risk to have gone, you know, these are the guys that they want to become starters. You know, you can't just like wait around forever and use, you know, veterans and not bring these guys acclimate to the major league level. But we could be in a little bit of an adjustment period for their pitching staff dealing with not getting the edge strikes that they really kind of need to survive because there's bar, or the, like Grant Taylor, they called him up like last week and instantly has like all like the hardest pitches that the White Sox have thrown because they just do not have a lot of big fastballs on the staff.
Yeah, it's tough. And then I guess there's also the controlling the run game aspect, which is a little bit more now and a tiny samples, but Teal and Caro both look, you know, okay. I know Teal's got the big pop times and things like that. So that's a lot of the youth infusion on the position player side. You mentioned Luis Robert Jr. having a tough year, and I wanted to get your read on what his future is going to be. So he's hitting .190, you know, barely, not even OPSing 600, was leading the league in stolen bases at one point, but I'm sure that doesn't make up for, again, hitting .190. $20 million team option each of the next 2 years. What do you make of what his future is going to be? I know, like, the national guys always kind of helicopter around, would Luis Robert Jr. be available in trade? Those two options are, if he bounces back, reasonable. What do you make of where the organization's at with Luis Robert now and then maybe in the winter?
I don't think they want to see him in the winter.
Okay.
Those options, on top of being more expensive than I think any contract that they're carrying right now, I don't think they're even interested in paying the $2 million buyout. Now, maybe they'll have to remove him and avoid some costs that they might otherwise have to pay, but I think this was kind of their final window to get out from under it. Otherwise, it's a lot of like throwing good money after bad, where it's a guy who's now, you know, been bad for a season and a half, and you're trying to pick up more options to see like if he'll get back to his potential. I don't think that's something they're going to do. They're trying to unload this money. They might have to eat some money to do it, but they're trying to kind of move out from under this. And I think it'd be better for Luis at this point. Like the idea of like, hey, you're going to get traded because this team's rebuilding has been hanging over him for at least a year, if not longer. And he's mentioned it being a distraction at times. So they're not going to get anywhere near what they thought. Certainly not when they, you know, held on to him during this offseason, and certainly not what they thought coming off of his All-Star 2023 campaign. But it's both for him, for, you know, the direction of the team and kind of establishing what they're going to be after him, for clearing more money off their payroll. It's all, hey, we got to just see what we get next month at this point. I can't fully wrap my mind around why the bat has gone so bad, especially with, you know, if anything, he's taking more pitches and chasing less than before. It kind of seems like it's throwing his timing off of whack, and he's not aggressive in the zone the way he once was. And I don't know how you reverse that, but change of scenery seems like the best idea at this point.
Yeah, that was going to be my follow-up question. What is behind this steep drop in production? And I guess, you know, the trade talks and rebuilds, like those things can indeed be a distraction, but it's still puzzling, right? To see a guy like Luis Robert Jr. just not produce at all, aside from stolen bases.
And like get benched for a couple days to try to figure it out is something you just don't see all that.
Yeah. And what do you do to reverse that? Is it as simple as a change of scenery? It becomes a very fascinating discussion, James, around a guy who, you know, at one point was among the best hitters in the American League, probably.
I mean, pretty much since he called up, he's been like hyper aggressive. And it's always been like, well, he's pretty good, but like, what if he like didn't chase at like the highest rate in the league? And so I think the adjustments for him, you know, for years has been like chase less. Take more pitches. And, you know, I asked him at the end of last year, I've asked him portions of this year where like, hey, is all this kind of emphasis on like shutting down your swing or especially as he stopped performing as well on like fastballs in the zone, do you feel like this is taking away your aggressiveness or kind of gotten you off your rhythm or your timing? And at multiple points he said yes. Sometimes he said like, no, I'm fine. But it seems like the guy who kind of just would explode on any mistake has slipped away in some way. And I'm not saying he should, you know, go back to chasing at 40% of pitches outside the zone just to see what happens, but it does feel like maybe we got this guy away from what his, you know, best mindset was a little bit, and, you know, it overloaded him with information. He used to be a guy, you know, even talking, he's like, hey, when I was playing in Cuba, they told me what pitches the guy had and how hard he threw, and then I went out there and figured it out. And, you know, they've been trying to get him to absorb a lot more advanced game prep and work the way that we think, you know, the best hitters should work, but maybe it got him a little off of the process that worked for him. And he's still kind of trying to find that balance again.
Yeah, far away from 38 home runs at this point, stuck on 6 years through 67 games. James, this series, we're going to see Davis Martin, Aaron Civale, and Adrian Hauser, as you kind of provided us there. With respect to Davis Martin tonight, what are we looking for? The strikeout rate's so low, but also so is the walk rate. I don't know. Some of the under the hood stuff is not as favorable as the baseball card stat line. What have you seen from Davis Martin? What should we be looking for tonight?
I mean, I've kind of always wondered why he hasn't missed as many bats. Cause mid-May, he kind of made some adjustments. He has a new slider grip that's like a bit more of a high 80s slider. He was throwing kind of a more softer sweeper, and he's had some nights, especially like I want to say late May in Cincinnati, where, you know, he was dominant and he looked like a different guy. And he's done some biomechanical stuff where he was sitting a bit more 94, 95 as a result, because he was generating more ground force down the mound. The kick change.
Yeah.
It never quite plays as well as like you thought like the first time when it emerged, and then everyone started adjusting to it. But it is a 92 mile an hour changeup that like falls off the side of the earth. I don't know if it's locating it or guys like, you know, game plans being built around it. He's got a lot of weapons where when it's popping, it's like, yeah, this seems right. This guy's throwing like 95 with a lot of like really hard breaking stuff. You know, he should be a good pitcher. At the same time, like his results have been, you know, pretty good. It's been better than his peripheral. So like, he's 28, I want to say. He's really early in his control because he was kind of a late bloomer and then had TJ, which was in the minors, so he didn't accumulate service time. I think, I don't know if, like, I'm not versed on, like, whether the Blue Jays have rotational need. I think that you do because of
yes.
the whole Bowden Francis thing. But, like, I think he's a guy that, like, you know, I know the White Sox coaching staff loves him. They wouldn't want to see him go. But as far as, like, their window and as far as how much control he has and also being a little bit older and not really knowing, like, does he fit in the future, like, I think he's a guy that people should ask for at the deadline because he's a controllable, like, mid to back end starter. And I think the ingredients are probably a little bit more intriguing than maybe the under the hood numbers right now. But if he went and became a guy who kind of reliably gave you, like, seasons of 3.70 ERA, I think that's about right. I think really highly of Davis Martin.
Yeah, he might be a guy who is possibly on the move, and a guy who just arrived is probably also going to be at least asked about at the trade deadline in Aaron Civale. And I guess my question is, one, how has Civale looked since he got there? And two, will he finish the season with the White Sox, in your opinion?
Probably not if things go well. he is an expiring deal. I think anybody who's not, like, got more – anyone who's not in pre-arb with the White Sox should at least, like, check in with Getz before the deadline. Like, hey, how's the standing are? But I think certainly Civale would be someone who, look, they have a lot of young pitchers. There's a use for him to, you know, be a guy who can soak up innings. I don't think, like, it'll be a bad scene if he's here past the deadline. The way, like, with Robert, it'll just be like, well, how long this is going to go on. But, yeah, it's an expiring veteran starter who's, you know, been valuable to flip before, and I think they'd certainly will look to do it again. He's had one start. You know, it was kind of weird. He had three walks in the first inning. Will Venable, who's, like, one of the nicer people on earth, started screaming at Marvin Hudson about it and got ejected in a way I've never seen. Then kind of steady from there. It's very much a White Sox starter. He throws 7 to 8 pitches. There's no, like, big fastball, but there's, like, this constant mix, and you wonder, like, man, how are we in the fifth? We've been doing nothing but kind of, like, medium deep flyouts against this guy all night. he doesn't look like he's overwhelming us, but, like, it's 2-1 in the sixth inning, what's going on situation. So, yeah, I think he fits into their mold of someone who tries to generate a lot of weak contact, you know, throws from a really weird high arm slot and then throws a lot of cutters. Like, he's an unusual look, and they love getting their little, like, unusual unicorn type pitchers who aren't necessarily good, but, like, just throw you a different look where it's hard to adjust to them over the course of a night. So I think he fits in pretty well.
Nice. That's it's an interesting mix they got going. Then we won't see Shane Smith, but one of the all-time success Rule 5 picks. So a little cooking on the pitching side, at least. James, before I let you go here, I've always enjoyed your Sox work. And when you dabble at Baseball America, you're also doing some more prospect stuff now at Fangraphs with Eric Loggenhagen as well, including the Jays top 40 over at Fangraphs, if anyone saw that in April. Just curious, professionally, like, how are you enjoying getting to lean into the prospect stuff a little bit more outside of just the White Sox system?
I think it's very useful. I mean, it's kind of like a palate cleanser in terms of, like, understanding what players look like across the league. And, you know, I mean, I barely have time to do my jobs, but I just think if you can, from a fan perspective, just, like, watch other teams as much as you possibly can. Cause, like, you know, I know, like, everyone loves their favorite team. I know I watch a disproportionate amount of White Sox games, so I'm one to judge. But, like, it just gives you such, like, a view of, like, how the rest of the league works and what looks normal, and also helps you understand your own team better. So I think it's something that, like, not every beat writer should just become a prospect writer. It's extremely hard, and I'm very tired. But I think it just gives you an appreciation of, like, what different talent looks like across the league and, like, what kind of helps rosters. So I think it's made White Sox work better, and I think anyone who, like, wants to even understand their own team better, just looking at, like, a broader perspective is helpful.
Yeah, which is something Michael Bauman at Fangraphs is doing, the interesting thing with the fan exchange going on right now, where Jays fans are supposed to be watching Braves games and Mets fans are supposed to be watching Jays games and so on. And I guess the nice thing for you too is if the White Sox make a trade with, like, the Twins or the Royals or the Blue Jays or something like that, you're ready to go. You know all these guys already. You know who you want from the Jays, like, high A ball team and things like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, generally, unless I'm wrong, I'm, you know, talking about, like, my list, I'm now looking at, like, how optimistic I was about Aurelvis Martinez, and Now hanging my head in shame, but
yeah, you're not alone in that one though. At least, yeah, it's a tough one. And getting some first base reps now. There's a lot going on there. James, thanks so much for doing this, man. Really appreciate all the great work, and you make a time out this morning.
Thanks for having me,
James Vagan, Sox Machine, FanGraphs, Baseball America. Yeah, it should be a fun series here. I have one note that I didn't want to keep him on the line and ask him about this, but I have two former Blue Jays notes here, and they're both sad.
Oh.
The first is that Rowdy Tellez has been designated for assignment by the Seattle Mariners. Oh. That's not entirely surprising, given, yeah, I think the only homers he has on the season were the here against Toronto.
Yep.
And then Vinny Capra, who you may remember from a 7 plate appearance stint in 2022 with the Toronto Blue Jays, is on this Chicago White Sox team. He also played for the Brewers briefly earlier this year. On the season, he has, and this is a fascination that I've brought up before and we've joked about, he has a negative weighted runs created plus right now, which I don't really know how to contextualize because, you know, 100 is supposed to be average, 200 is your double the value of an average guy. Don't really know how you get to a negative. However, he has had 92 plate appearances. He's hitting .106 and OPSing under 300. So weighted runs created plus, which takes all of that and it adjusts for ballpark and league factors and things like that. I tried to see the last time someone had 90 plate appearances and had a stat line that bad.
Yep.
Is Roy Halladay. That's how far back you have to go. And it's a pitcher for the last time someone had 90 plate appearances with a weighted runs created plus this low. On the position player only side, no one has finished a season with 90 plate appearances and a batting line this bad since 1973.
Mm-hmm.
So the two things could happen here. Vinny Capra will hit a little better because he's a major league player. It's almost impossible to hit worse. Or he's going to get cut at some point, and he will be just short of Pete Mackinnon of 1973, who had a .268 OPS over 98 plate appearances.
Wow. Yeah, if you have to go that far back.
Roy Halladay, the last guy to hit his
bat. Not expect to hear Roy Halladay's
name. I didn't
name.
Expect to see Roy. I was like, quadruple checked my query. I was like, what is going on here? This can't be right. And then I had to filter out all the pitchers because it's basically only pitchers.
I am so glad that you didn't put that in our shared doc or mention it ahead of time. Because I really wanted that shock factor that you provided there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, not the nicest stat that I've ever shared on the show, but what are you going to do?
Probably the funniest, honestly.
If Vinny Capra sees me at the park later, I'm going to catch a beat down, but I don't know. The stat is what it is. All right, so we got Spencer Turnbull against Davis Martin tonight. We'll continue to get you set up for that one in this final segment. We're also going to talk to Michelle Seniak of the Toronto Blue Jays. She's their senior VP of fan experience and concessions. We'll talk about Pride Night that's going down tonight. We'll talk about it a little bit. I also wanted to mention that on Blue Jays Central tonight at 6:30, Emily Agard has a feature coming on the Not-So-Amazon Toronto Softball League, which is a queer plus trans non-gender neutral softball league in the city. So feature on that on Blue Jays Central as part of Pride Night tonight as well. So keep an eye out for that. If you are not at the ballpark, getting your crossbody bag and enjoying all the, I got to look through the list of, I forgot to check all the themed foods for tonight.
Oh, yes.
And things like that as well. But we'll get into all of it in this final segment as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. If you're headed down to the ballgame tonight, it is City Connect Friday. It is also Pride Night at the Blue Jays game. So you will get Church Street Burger Fries if you are so inclined. Those are French fries with burger toppings on them. There's also Rainbow Sangria. Forte, the Toronto Gay Men's Chorus, will sing the national anthem. Melanie King Gavin, who does a lot of work with the 519, which is right around the corner from me. I keep giving away my. I'm just going to give my address.
And the funniest thing is that he's not doing it on purpose.
No, I'm not. It's like when I gave away the Washington Nationals thing the other day. I'm just, I'm just
You're getting
dumb.
Too comfortable. It's like we're just chatting right
yeah.
now.
Anyway, shout out to Melanie King-Gavin, who will throw out the first pitch. Let's talk about what the Blue Jays are doing here and why they're doing it. Let's talk to Michelle Senyuk, Blue Jays Senior Vice President of Fan Experience and Concessions. Michelle, good morning. How much are you looking forward to today?
Good morning. I am very much looking forward to today. Today is one of my favorite days at the ballpark every year.
Yeah, listen, Michelle, it's a fun time. It's always a fun time, right? I'm wondering for you, I guess the opportunity here to sort of link Pride Night with a City Connect night in the interest of bringing in a more diverse audience, a more diverse fan base to the ballpark. What were some of the opportunities that you identified in being able to do it on a City Connect night?
Yeah, well, City Connect and being able to do it on a Friday night with that tie this year was a fun new tie for us, in more so just creativity of being able to bring new things to the ballpark. We love our City Connect logo and everything we were able to do with the jersey as we launched it last year. And now we're able to make that Pride. So we were able to change, you know, our City Connect skyline, our T logo into Pride colors. And that was really exciting for us to be able to integrate that. But City Connect is about bringing the city together. It's bringing, you know, Toronto into the ballpark. And we're able to do that tonight with, you know, different things that we're bringing in, as well as, you know, encouraging fans across our diverse city to join us here.
So this is the sixth Pride night the Blue Jays are doing. And in the interest of, you know, bringing in, making the ballpark a more inclusive experience, bringing in a more diverse fan base, how have you guys tried to measure that effect over the first five Pride nights? And how will you with this one? Obviously, you can't exactly have like KPIs around the stadium or whatever, but what does success look like for you guys in terms of feeling like you're moving in the right direction with inclusivity at the ballpark and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, we believe that baseball is for everyone, not just on Pride Night. Every night at the ballpark, we want everyone to feel welcome and feel like they belong here. And Pride Night, it is hard to measure KPIs, but I would say any night at the ballpark, whether it be tonight or another, if people are coming here, if fans are coming and having a great time, then that's the best KPI that you can ask for. If they enjoy their experience, if they, you know, of course we love when we win and we love when our players do well on the field and we have a great game. But when you come to a game with your friends and your family, chances are you remember the memories that you've had with them and the memories that you created that night. And that's really the most important to us, is that people come down here and have a great time every time they come through our gates.
So in the interest of putting together a fun as well as authentic Pride Night, who are you sort of talking to, drawing inspiration from? Are there organizations that you're maybe consulting in how to make this, you know, both fun and true to the queer culture that exists in Toronto?
Yeah, great question. We have been so lucky over all of our years of hosting this night to be able to work with incredible organizations. This year, you know, we've partnered again with TD, who have such a great presence with the 2S LGBTQ plus community. We also worked this year with Pride Toronto, who was so great in helping us make this an authentic evening. But in other years, we've worked with AIDS Committee of Toronto, Sherburn Health, the 519, Youth Line. There are so many great organizations in Toronto that really support the community in such meaningful ways with incredible education and programs. And, you know, for us, we're so thankful that they're willing to partner with us to help us make this an authentic night.
So in terms of the night and the authenticity of it, I mentioned a couple of the things going on before we brought you on here. What do we have tonight? What's cooking? What's the thing that you're most looking forward to at the ballpark?
I think new this year is, and I'm most looking forward to, drag bingo, which I am the most excited to take part in. So that's happening tonight at the ballpark. We have an incredible glam zone where you can go and get your makeup done, or you can get bedazzled face jewels. We have the Powder Puff Girls, who are going to be joining us. You may have seen some of them on Canada's Drag Race, which is really exciting to have them here. They'll be in the WestJet flight deck performing and taking photos. And then we have, you know, don't miss our pregame festivities. Get here early to get your crossbody bag. But also Forte Gay Men's Chorus is performing the anthem tonight. And every time they perform, it just makes me so emotional to hear them. They are such an incredible group, and I love to hear them sing.
Julia, I know you're a professional and you have to be covering the game, but given your recent stretch of losing every drag bingo game, have your plans for tonight changed hearing that they're going to happen at the park?
It will be hard to remain professional, but I think it's better if I stay away because honestly, no one wants me throwing a fit because I lost a drag bingo again. It's nothing personal, but I was also very excited to see that drag bingo was happening because it's such a unique thing, Michelle, within the community. I'm wondering, one, where that idea came from, and two, are there challenges in having that done at a ballpark in a situation like this?
Great question. In terms of where the idea came from, it's such a big activity, I would say, in Toronto. There's so many places that you can go for drag brunch, and Torontonians are really, embracing drag bingo. So we thought, why not give it a shot? I'm not going to say it's going to go perfectly because I don't want to set myself up for failure, but we're going to try something new. It's on the 100 level concourse at section 130. It's a shortened game of bingo. So, we have to make it quick and fast. Given all the folks that come through our gates, we want to make sure everyone has the opportunity to try and play if they're coming in, and we'll see how it goes. I'm excited too. I would like you to join us, Julia.
Okay.
And if you lose, that's okay.
Thank you for that.
You say if she loses, it's okay, but it took me a good full segment of the show to get her out of. Yeah,
Grumpy.
The last time she lost the drag bingo. So, although we do have, this is a Friday and we don't have a show until Monday, so not my problem, I guess.
It would end up on social media. Michelle, I have a couple more for you and then we'll let you go here because we know this is a busy day for you, obviously. But, let's stick with the organization here for a little bit. This has been going on for years now. And, we're wondering why this is still important for the Blue Jays. What do the Blue Jays want to achieve in bringing back Pride Night year over year?
Yeah, I mean, baseball, like I said, is for everyone. And, it's really important to us to continue to bring this not only here, but beyond the ballpark. And, Pride Night is a great night and it's a lot of fun to put on this event, but it's even more important the work that we get to do year round. Whether that be training our employees every year on how to, be educated to make the ballpark an inclusive experience for everyone, or whether it be Jays Care, who's training our educators and coaches across Canada to make sure that they're creating inclusive sports environments for kids, from the 2S LGBTQ plus community, or our baseball academy, who, offers free workshops to coaches and league administrators, who, put the tools and resources together for them to help create more equitable and inclusive programming. It's just, really important to us to make sure that people do feel that sport is for everyone.
And then just more on a personal note, I guess, I am wondering how meaningful this is for you. You mentioned this is your favorite night, and obviously it's a fun night, but you do a lot of these sort of thematic nights at the ballpark. We see it with cricket night, for example, right? And this real effort in bringing in more fans and fans from different walks of life. How meaningful is it for you to be able to be part of something like this year over year?
It's incredibly meaningful for me. Personally, I have a lot of family members and close friends who are part of the queer community and who are part of the sports community. So for me to be able to bring that together for them, it's so, incredible to see how they come to this night and they see how important it is to us. And it's important for me. And it's been important for me, since I started here. And I'm really proud of the work that we do, not only in the ballpark, but across the community.
Michelle, that's really well said. And we're looking forward to tonight. Appreciate you coming on and sharing some of what goes into the planning of Pride Night tonight and why it's important to the Blue Jays organization. Really appreciate it, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
Michelle Senyuk, Blue Jays Senior Vice President of Fan Experience and Concessions. And yeah, get down there early, get your crossbody bag, play some drag bingo, beat Julia in drag bingo. I'm not exactly sure the specifics of, can I ask a really novice question? How does it being drag bingo, does that just mean a queen is the one drawing the numbers and the other parts of the bingo are, you still have, B7 and 061 or whatever?
Yeah.
So you don't have to, there's no difference to the bingo side of it. It's just much livelier.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And listen, my experience has also included just, you know, a few lip sync numbers and things like that to sort of mix
beverages.
It up. Yeah, a lot of that. And yeah.
You actually did have bingo. You just missed it.
Yeah, perhaps. Honestly, very possible. One Jelly King is all it takes.
Oh, yeah. Good choice, though. Good choice. Okay. So it is Pride Night tonight, and the teams around baseball do different things for this. If you're the Rangers, you don't do anything at all. If you're the Mariners, you put a lot of thought into a thoughtful video explaining why this is still necessary. If you're the Dodgers, your star player makes a doofus of himself to kind of undercut the night. To you, Julia, when you see baseball still doing this, when you see the Blue Jays still doing this for a sixth year, why is it important to you?
Listen, I think this is about visibility and inclusion as much as anything else. I think it's important because just a couple of weeks ago, my wife encountered an anti-gay protest near our house, and it was straight up an anti-gay protest in Toronto on Yonge Street, right? It's important because we have players wearing their pride hat and adding a Bible verse as if to say that one thing cannot coexist with the other, which I would disagree, right? It's that it yes. has been my experience, at least, that those two things can coexist.
And yes, and that verse specifically can be interpreted two very different
in a variety ways.
An extremely inclusive way and an extremely exclusive way.
Yeah, it's important because you still have players who are refusing to wear pride gear when it's, you know, team oriented and things along those lines. So I think the main thing, and I go back to even an interview that I did with Kevin Gausman a couple years ago when things got ugly in Toronto as well.
Is this when he stepped up to catch the first pitch that year?
Caught the ceremonial first pitch there. And what he said was, listen, I'm always here for this because they come to the ballpark, fans come to the ballpark, and they support us. And they need to know that we support them as well. Support needs to go both ways here. And when you sort of look at the way things have gone and you know, the fact that 2 years ago, the Dodgers had their Pride Night, and there were protests going on outside of the stadium. So people were arriving for Pride Night, and they were encountered with religious protests and things like that. I'm a Catholic. I was born and raised Catholic. My mom is still very, my parents are both very active in the community. These things can coexist. They really can. And sports, again, they are for everyone, and the ballpark is for everyone. So I think this is important because we're not trying to change anyone's minds here. We're trying to let kids know, you know, people that are growing up and that are finding themselves and that are trying to figure out how they fit into this world, that they do have a place. They do have a place in sports. They do have a place at the ballpark. And they don't just need to observe. They can be part of this. That is what we're trying to do. Again, I'm not trying to change anyone's minds here, Blake. I'm just trying to guarantee that people feel seen, that people feel heard, and most of all, that they feel inserted into a community that is there for them too. And I think that's the importance of Pride Night still.
And I think that's really well said, and it's important for people to hear. And I'm curious. So the Kevin Gausman example is an extreme one on the positive end. The Anthony Bass stuff happens, and not only will he not do it, he ends up getting cut and we've never seen him or heard from him again. And Kevin Gausman steps up and puts his hand up and mm-hmm. says, I'm willing to do that. I want to be a part of this, and catches the first pitch. That is obviously an explicitly meaningful gesture from him. How meaningful is it to just have Bo Bichette just walking around doing his BP in the Blue Jays Pride shirt, like it's the Kevin Gausman giveaway shirt, yeah. like it is not an ask for the players to, because again, Gausman stepped up, that was a necessary thing,
yeah.
But the element of some of these players will accept and embrace and celebrate as if it's nothing to them, yeah. Because it's the most obvious thing or the most casual thing in the world.
Yeah, I mean, that was a few years ago. I think that we were very much on track for that. I can tell you that we have taken some significant steps back, mm-hmm. which is a problem. You're wearing a t-shirt right now as if it's nothing, right?
Yeah.
And that is really cool, but it is also a reminder that we're still very much fighting for kids' rights to play sports and to play sports in whatever gender they feel like represents them the best, and things along those lines, right? This goes beyond Major League Baseball. It's bigger than that. And so I dream of the day that we can go back to just acting as if it's nothing and wearing a t-shirt as if it's nothing and it's totally fine. that is why we need to keep doing it and we need to keep talking about it. And I think we're going to have Pride Night for a long time, and we're going to have difficult discussions around Pride Night for a long time, unfortunately. But I think it starts with us, right? It's been a while since I've had this type of platform to really speak up and to, you know, share my thoughts and opinions and feelings. I have received nothing but love and support since I moved here, and it's been incredible, whether that's at the ballpark, Blue Jays staff, you know, fans, audience, whatever it is. And that has been great. It's not everyone's experience, and that's why we're here talking about this.
Yeah, that's well said. And I'm glad that has been your experience. I hope it becomes everyone's experience as we move forward. And again, this is obviously centered on Major League Baseball, but this is, like you said, this is about more than just Major League Baseball and the Toronto Blue Jays. If you are interested in learning more about what some of that looks like at the adult level around the city of Toronto, again, there's a Blue Jays Central feature airing tonight on NOTSO, the Amazon Softball League for Toronto, queer plus, trans, gender neutral, et cetera, community that has been operating since the 80s. In the city.
Really
Emily
cool.
Agard went down there and did a feature on that. That'll air on Blue Jays Central tonight. And then, of course, if you are at the ballpark, yes, it's fun to have rainbow sangria and get the crossbody bag that I'm remembering the term on it now and not saying fanny pack and things like that. But make sure, as with any of these nights, you know, if there's a Latin Heritage Night or Roberto Clemente Night or Jackie Robinson Night, it's important to celebrate and acknowledge, but also engage with it. Think critically about why this is necessary. When you're wearing the pride flag, what does that mean? If you are, you know, again, on Jackie Robinson Day, on whatever, yesterday was Juneteenth, the Blue Jays played, and this is Canada, so it's not a holiday. But if you are a fan in the U.S., mm-hmm. you know, engage with the why of these as well and think critically about it. So, Julie, thank you so much for sharing your perspective on that.
Oh, no worries. I'm going to need a nap after this because it always takes so much out of me to, to, you know, be present. But this was one of those moments where you kind of have to. If I don't speak up, you know.
I mean, look, you don't have to. You don't have to carry it for everyone, but it's great that you felt that you could and that you wanted to. Awkwardly, now we have 4 minutes to fill. So
now we have to talk about baseball again. Sure.
Let's talk about Davis Martin and how, if the night goes well, he will get hammered for like 30 home runs. 3.79 ERA. Davis Martin comes in with this into this one too. We talked to James Fagan a little earlier about kind of the weirdness in Davis Martin. It's the expected ERA, if you like that kind of stat, says he shouldn't be this good. He's not striking enough guys out. He's not missing enough bats. The contact's pretty hard. And then you look at the pitch-specific stuff, it's like, no, this guy's good. This guy's funky. He's got a kick change. So for anyone who doesn't know, when James said kick change, by the way, most guys who throw a changeup are supinators. So they're the guys who can't effectively pronate that well when they release the spin on the ball. So the changeup is normally a supinator pitch. The kick change is guys are learning to throw it while pronating. So it's really fascinating because they come in a lot harder. Right. They get more vertical break, but as I understand it, it's like very hard to learn. Like a lot of the guys would rather try to learn a splitter if that's the case instead of a changeup. And when we talk about the splitter as an off-speed pitch, so it'll be interesting to see. Does Davis Martin's changeup look kind of like a soft split or a hard splitter rather? Anyway, I'm fascinated to talk to some of the Blue Jays tomorrow that see it about what it looked like and if it is as funky as it sounds.
Yeah, because it sounds like this isn't really a pitch that's necessarily trying to emulate a fastball as much and fool you in that sense. It's more about vertical break and whether it can miss bats that way, which is not what a changeup is. And I'm wondering if we're going to start seeing different classifications for different types of changeups. We spoke yesterday about that on the show and just how much diversity exists around this
pitch. It was interesting. So this didn't make the show because it was a little too, we ran out of time for the softball stuff with Madison Shipman the other day, but she was actually telling me like some of the analytics stuff at the women's softball level is like, it's grown a lot, but because softball's different than baseball, it has trouble with some things like some fast pitch curveballs are thrown the same and move the same, but like because the different ways you can grip and throw a softball, you can have like 8 miles an hour difference in a curveball and it's coming from the same pitcher and they all get lumped in as curveball.
Yep.
So like you really, to Madison's point about how she's a video person, by the way, since we had that segment, Madison's sister's on fire.
Really?
Homers in back-to-back games.
We love that. Also, I didn't know that Madison was actually celebrating an anniversary the day that she was with us.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
We should have said congrats. congrats.
Birthdays, I remember. Anniversaries, I got nothing. Like that day, I remembered it was Chris Black and Caleb Joseph's birthday.
Right.
But
well, listen,
that's it.
You know, added benefit for you here. You don't have to remember an anniversary because you're single.
Thanks. Thanks, bud. Spencer Turnbull will start for the Blue Jays on the other side. We expect him, if things go well, to be able to get up to about 80 pitches. Paxton Schultz, Eric Lauer, and Justin Brule are obviously down. Brule's pitched back-to-back days. Paxton Schultz threw 40 pitches yesterday. But that still means six arms in the bullpen should be green. We could see some churn in the bullpen there. Nathan Lucas is expected to be activated today, so someone will have to go down there or to the IL if Miles Straw is not recovering that well. So there will be a flurry of pregame transactions in addition to drags, bingo, and things like that. There'll be a lot going on your Twitter feed around 3 o'clock. That's it.
Yeah. It'll be a busy night. It'll be a fun night.
Busy weekend for you, eh?
Busy weekend for me. Yes. I don't have an off day until July now.
Yeah. I think I looked and I only have 5 for all of June and July.
Phew.
So it's a tough one. Whatever. It's talk about sports. I'll survive. I'm taking my mom and stepdad to the game tomorrow, too, after I do a little Blue Jays Central. That's it for today and for this week. Thank you to Jorge Castillo, James Fagan, and Michelle Senyuk for joining us. Thanks to Amit Mann, Jake Scholes, and James Wilson behind the glass. Spencer Turnbull against Davis Martin. You got Blair and Barker 4-6 and post game. Ben, Joe, Hazel, and Emily on the call tonight. And again, check out that Blue Jay Central feature. Pre-game, have a wonderful weekend.